America has given us an unprecedented and powerful mandate.
Has America? Have they really? Are you sure about that?
Well, I don't know why I came here tonight.
That's why.
I got the feeling that something ain't right.
No, it ain't.
I'm so scared in case I fall off my chair. And I'm wondering how I'll get down the stairs. Clowns to the left of me, jokers to the right. Here I am, stuck in the middle with you.
Yes, I am. From Pacifica Radio in Los Angeles, this is the Bradcast, as heard on KPFK 90.7 FM in LA and elsewhere in California, Oregon, Pennsylvania, Hawaii, Ohio, New York, Louisiana, New Mexico, New Hampshire, Arkansas, Washington State, Virginia, West Virginia, Wisconsin, Minnesota, and other fine terrestrial affiliates around the world, and yes, coast to coast, and streaming every day on the internets on a whole bunch of stations where you can also download us from your favorite podcast sites. I'm Brad Friedman, your friendly investigative blogger, journalist, troublemaker, muckraker, and all-around swell fellow, says me, from bradblog.com. Thank you very much for joining us today. As you heard at the top of the show, Donald Trump claimed in the very early morning hours on the night of his election victory on November 5th that the American people had given him a, quote, unprecedented and powerful mandate. Desi Doyen, unprecedented and powerful.
Yes, yes, I know.
In fact, it was neither unprecedented nor particularly powerful. And now that we know the final numbers, Trump defeated Kamala Harris by less than 1.5 percentage points of the popular vote, in which he once again failed to win a majority of the vote from Americans, unlike, I don't know, say Joe Biden in 2020. And even in the Electoral College, while Trump won 312 to 226, that was just six more electoral votes than Joe Biden won in 2020, out of a total of 538 available to be won. Begging the question, never mind unprecedented and powerful, was Trump's victory even a mandate at all for anything? And by the way, what is a mandate? We will be joined momentarily by someone who literally wrote the book on presidential political mandates to discuss exactly that. But first, a few news items of note today. We need to start out here in California, where the at times apocalyptic wildfire that we reported on yesterday out in Malibu, which though we don't know how it was sparked yet, was whipped into a terrifying conflagration thanks to both exceptionally dry conditions, thanks to climate change, and exceedingly high gusting winds that can happen, that do happen this time of year out here.
1,532 fire personnel are assigned to the incident, and crews are working tirelessly around the clock to establish containment lines and defend structures. 33 hours into this firefight, our primary focus remains the safety of residents and first responders.
That was L.A. County Fire Chief Anthony Maroney on Wednesday discussing the fire in Malibu, which has been dubbed the Franklin Fire. Officials in Southern California reported significant overnight growth of that wind-driven wildfire that has forced thousands of people, including celebrities like Cher and Dick Van Dyke, from their homes in Malibu. With much of the coastal city under evacuation orders and warnings, residents waited anxiously to see whether their properties had been spared by the fire, which erupted late on Monday and grew to more than 6 square miles. It was just 7% contained as of airtime on Wednesday, though forecasters said firefighters could soon get a break from improving weather conditions. That's good. The National Weather Service said the strongest Santa Ana winds, with gusts that reached 40 miles per hour, have now passed. Those winds blow in from the
desert.
From the desert,
so they're
out
super,
to the ocean.
They're warm and they're super, super dry.
And that 40 miles per hour was actually a break from what the Weather Service had feared on Monday night when they had predicted a possibility of hurricane force winds. as they issued an unusual, quote, particularly dangerous situation warning. And yes, that's what they officially call it. It goes along with their red flag warnings due to the particularly dangerous possibility of a tremendous fire being sparked amid these gale force winds. If any spark at all happens, it can be blown for miles under such conditions. But even as the weather was expected to continue to improve, critical fire conditions remain. The L.A. County Fire Chief said the fire grew by nearly 40% overnight. At least 7,500 structures, mostly homes, were threatened, with at least 12,600 people now under evacuation orders, according to officials. Much of the devastation so far has occurred in Malibu, which is a community of about 10,000 people on the western edge of Los Angeles, which you've probably seen in countless Hollywood films over the years. Flames burn near horse farms, celebrity seaside mansions, and Pepperdine University, where students were forced to shelter in place on campus for a second night in a row on Tuesday.
Also around Malibu Creek State Park, which is where a lot of MASH, the TV show, was filmed.
And it is not, by the way, only celebrity homes and students at that upscale Pepperdine who are at risk. There are, in fact, thousands of working class folks and rural ranch owners who are considered to be the heart of the coastal and mountain community. Sean Smith said he was asleep early Tuesday when someone knocked on his mobile home to wake him up to evacuate the Malibu RV park around 3 a.m. Yes, there is a Malibu RV park. He said you could see the fires rolling in over the canyon. It was like, holy crap, this is real, he said. He returned Wednesday to find that the RV park had been saved.
Oh, good.
Firefighters stopped the flames just before they entered the area. But for hours, Smith said, no one knew whether they would return to rubble or not. Here's L.A. County Supervisor Lindsay Horvath.
Our evacuated households are waiting with bated breath. A second night without power or cell service is extremely difficult for those not under evacuation. Thank you for checking in on one another. Thank you for remaining vigilant as we get this fire under control.
Lonnie Vidari's four-bedroom home in the Malibu Knolls neighborhood is one of seven that were destroyed so far. Vidari is already looking for a temporary home to rent. He thinks it will be at least 6 months until they can start to do repairs, and he's not expecting much help from insurance because he has only a basic fire policy with California's insurer of last resort. He said, quote, I don't even know anybody with insurance in Malibu anymore. Why would they not have insurance in Malibu, Desi Doyen?
Well, because insurers have been fleeing the state due to the massive increase in claims. That's because of more storms, more fires, more floods, especially fires due to climate change.
Oh, due to climate change.
Yeah.
In his 10 years living there, Vidari has experienced four fire evacuations. This one got them. Alex Gellis, 31, stayed behind on Monday night to save his own home in Malibu's Serra Retreat neighborhood from the flames. That's the same neighborhood, by the way, where, as we mentioned on yesterday's show, Dick Van Dyke, who turns 99 on Friday, and his wife were forced to evacuate. Happy birthday. Gellis says he used pumps in his home from his home swimming pool to help spray water over the house and surrounding vegetation. He said the flames were within 5 feet of his home on all sides, saying, quote, the whole canyon was lit up. He said he purchased that pump for safety after the Woolsey fire that roared through the area back in 2018, killing three people and destroying 1,600 homes at the time. As of Wednesday morning, electricity was still out for about 13,500 Southern California Edison customers, including more than 6,000 in Malibu. The power was first shut off by the company to most customers in Malibu on Monday night to avoid the company's equipment sparking a fire amid those potential hurricane force winds. Edison's equipment was blamed for causing the devastating Woolsey fire back in 2018. because we are still not smart enough to bury our power equipment, our power lines in this country, no matter how many lives and homes it would likely save, because, you know, that would cost money to the power companies. We will, of course, continue to monitor the situation as wildfire season, once contained to just the, you know, the few hottest months of the year, is now actually pretty much a year-round phenomenon out here in California and for much of the western and southwestern U.S. in particular, as our climate crisis and your climate crisis continues to intensify. In other news today, FBI Director Christopher Wray told the Bureau workforce on Wednesday that he plans to resign on January 20 at the end of President Joe Biden's term, an announcement that came a week and a half after the incoming president, Donald Trump, said that he would nominate loyalist Kash Patel for the job. Wray said at a town hall meeting that he would be stepping down, quote, after weeks of careful thought, unquote. 3 years short of the completion of his 10-year term, which I see as the very definition of obeying in advance, as Yale historian and tyranny expert Timothy Snyder advises people to not do when faced with rising authoritarianism. But don't forget, Wray was a Trump appointee in the first place. During Trump's first term, after Trump had fired FBI Director James Comey for not being willing to be a loyalist stooge amid the Bureau's investigation into Russia's interference in the 2016 election. FBI directors are 10-year terms because it is supposed to insulate the agency from political influence of changing administrations. Those terms are supposed to overlap administrations, but so much for that, I guess. Those days appear to be over. By stepping down rather than waiting to be fired, Wray is trying to avert a collision with the new Trump administration that he said would have further entangled the FBI, quote, deeper into the fray, whatever that means. He said, quote, my goal is to keep the focus on our mission, the indispensable work you're doing on behalf of the American people every day. Wray told agency employees, he said, quote, in my view, this is the best way to avoid dragging the Bureau deeper into the fray while reinforcing the values and principles that are so important to how we do our work. The soft-spoken Wray rarely seemed to go out of his way to publicly confront the Trump White House, at least when he was in office. He did anger Trump from time to time, both during his first term and then during the Biden years. For example, last December, when Wray testified to Congress that there was, quote, no indication that Ukraine had interfered in the 2016 election, countering a frequent talking point at the time from Donald Trump. Wray angered Trump for saying that Antifa was a movement and an ideology, but not an actual organization, after Trump had said that he would like to designate the group as a terrorist organization. Wray described in detail Russian efforts to interfere in the 2020 election that Trump lost to Democrat Joe Biden, even though Trump maintained that China was the more assertive threat that year. Wray also said that the FBI had not seen evidence of widespread voter fraud, a claim that Trump repeatedly had pushed. But now, well, Wray is just quitting 3 years early rather than forcing Trump to fire him. Our friends at the good government watchdog Public Citizen had quick comment on the news today on Wray's apparent decision to obey in advance. Robert Weissman, the co-president of Public Citizen, issued a statement arguing, quote, FBI Director Christopher Wray should stay. He should rethink his decision to resign and finish out his 10-year term. FBI directors are given 10-year terms for a reason, to insulate them from political pressure, to defend the vital independence of the FBI. Director Wray should not preemptively resign in the face of Trump's bad faith threats to remove him. It is especially important, he said, that Wray stays in office in light of Donald Trump's announced intention to appoint Kash Patel to the petition, to the position. Patel is not only unqualified, he said he is a danger to America. Patel has already announced his intention to weaponize the FBI against Trump's perceived enemies, threatening a return to the agency's most sinister history, or worse, said Weissman, adding, if Donald Trump fires him, so be it. But Ray should not aid and abet the effort to weaponize the FBI by bowing out in advance. And finally, before we get to my guest today, not everybody is giving up in advance, at least at the state level. So that's good. Now, the last of the states are now completing their final certification of the 2024 election as they officially declare who won the presidential race and which electors, therefore, will represent their state in the Electoral College, Donald Trump's electors or Kamala Harris's electors. Those electors will then meet on December 17th at their respective state capitals to sign documents making their votes for the winner of the popular vote in each of those states, making that official. Those votes will then be sent to Congress to be counted and certified during a joint session on December 6th. January 6th. That joint session will be presided over by the president of the Senate, which happens to be Vice President Kamala Harris. So I'm sure that will be a fun day for her on January 6th. But in the meantime, state law enforcement officials are still holding those to account who attempted to steal the election through a fraudulent electoral vote scheme back in 2020. Wisconsin state prosecutors on Wednesday filed 10 additional felony charges against two attorneys and an aide to incoming President Donald Trump, who advised him in his 2020 campaign about a plan to submit paperwork falsely claiming that the Republican had won the battleground state that year. Oh, let's just pretend that Trump's electors were chosen by the people and we'll send that to Congress. I'm sure that'll all work just fine. Jim Troupas, who was Trump's attorney in Wisconsin, Kenneth Chesbro, an attorney who advised the campaign, and Mike Roman, Trump's director of Election Day operations back in 2020, all faced initially just a single felony forgery charge in Wisconsin for that. Those charges were filed in June. But on Tuesday, just 2 days before the three are scheduled for their initial court appearances, the Wisconsin Department of Justice filed 10 additional felony charges against each of them. Oh, I like it. The charges are for using forgery in an attempt to defraud each of the 10 Republican electors who cast their ballots for Trump that year, or who at least tried to. Each of the now 11 felony charges that they each face, that these three guys each face, carries the same maximum penalty of 6 years in prison and a $10,000 fine for each charge. And I must say, I do love the fact that these dopes and dupes who played along with Donald Trump in his first term, pretending in this case that he actually won an election in 2020 that he lost, these guys are all going to be fighting against felony charges. They're going to be fighting to stay out of prison, even as Trump takes office to enjoy a second term as president with complete immunity for all of his crimes, at least at the federal level, as granted to him by his corrupted U.S. Supreme Court majority this past summer. So Trump's going to be living large. And these folks, these dupes of his, will be facing trials and bankruptcy and jail time. And there's going to be nothing that Trump, at the federal level at least, can do about it, even if he wanted to, which, by the way, I suspect he could not care less about these people. The state charges against the Trump attorneys and aide are the only ones in Wisconsin. None of the fake electors, the fake Republican electors in that state from 2020, have been criminally charged. The 10 Wisconsin fake electors, along with Chesbro and Troopas, they all settled a civil lawsuit that was brought against them in 2023. But there are pending criminal charges related to the fake elector scheme in state and federal courts in Arizona, Michigan, Nevada, and Georgia. The Wisconsin complaint details how Troopas, Chesbro, and Roman created a document that falsely claimed that Donald Trump had won Wisconsin's 10 electoral college votes in 2020 and then attempted to deliver that document to then-Vice President Mike Pence. But in the amended complaint filed on Tuesday this week, prosecutors said the majority of the 10 electors had told investigators that they were told they needed to sign the elector certificate indicating that Trump had won only to preserve his legal options if a court had changed the outcome of the election in Wisconsin somehow. A majority of the electors told investigators that they did not believe that their signatures on the electoral certificate would actually be submitted to Congress without a court ruling, according to the complaint. So, yeah, they too were played for dupes, though I suspect a fair number of them almost certainly knew better and signed that document anyway. The Wisconsin charges were brought by Attorney General Josh Call, a Democrat. Yes, elections matter. They were filed originally in June, 5 months before Trump carried Wisconsin in November of this year. He also won the state in 2016, but he lost it in 2020. Chesbro and Roman were among those indicted along with Donald Trump in Georgia in a broad conspiracy case that, for now at least, still exists. Roman has pleaded not guilty to racketeering and conspiracy charges in Georgia. He's also pleaded not guilty to 9 felony charges in Arizona related to the fake electors plot in that state, including conspiracy, fraud, and forgery. Chesbro was one of 4 people to plead guilty in the Georgia case in the months following the indictment. But he's going to be in more trouble because he had actually lied about whether or not, when he cooperated with officials in a number of states, he actually lied about whether he had any secret Twitter accounts. In fact, it turns out he did. And he didn't tell the officials about it, which you are very much supposed to do when you are cooperating with federal or state law enforcement officials and they are giving you a break. You are supposed to tell them everything. If you don't, like, oh, you had a secret Twitter account in which you were putting out propaganda about the 2020 election. If you don't do that, you're in big trouble. So, Chesbro, you're in big trouble, buddy. Mm. All right, let's take a quick break here. We will come back to talk about the 2024 election moving forward and whether the guy who appears to have won it actually won a mandate somehow along with it for all of the madness that he promised throughout the campaign, or whether he didn't. Marquette University's Julia Azari, who wrote the book on presidential mandates, joins us next on the broadcast. I'm Brad Friedman.
Five major corporations now control more than 80% of the media in the United States, but they don't control us. The broadcast and the Green News Report are 100% independent, 100% listener-supported. But we can't do it alone. We need you. Please help us bring real facts to listeners at independent stations around the nation. You can make a difference. Support independent media. Drop by bradblog.com/donate. That's bradblog.com/donate. And thanks.
The gentleman is a dope, a man of many faults, a clumsy Joe who wouldn't know rumba from a waltz. The gentleman is a dope.
Welcome back. It's the Bradcast. Brad Friedman from bradblog.com. Just after Thanksgiving, the Los Angeles Times, Jenny Jarvie, wrote that in his victory speech on November 6th, Donald Trump claimed Americans had given him a, quote, unprecedented and powerful mandate. It's a message that his transition team has echoed in the weeks following Election Day, referring to his, quote, MAGA mandate and a, quote, historic mandate for his agenda. But given that Trump's lead in the popular vote has since dwindled as more votes were counted out here in California and other states that lean blue, Jarvie writes, there is fierce disagreement over whether most Americans really endorse his plans to overhaul government and implement sweeping changes. As what I believe to be the final national tally from the Cook Political Report's 2024 National Popular Vote Tracker, Donald Trump reportedly defeated Kamala Harris by less than 1.5 percentage points, or 1.48, but who's counting? He also, yet again, was unable to muster a majority of the national vote, with just over 50% voting for Harris or a third-party candidate, but not for Trump. The president-elect's share of the popular vote now falls in the bottom half for all American presidents, far below that of Democrat Lyndon B. Johnson, who won by 61% of the popular vote back in 1964, defeating Republican Senator Barry Goldwater by nearly 23 percentage points. As Jarvie reports, in the last 75 years, only three presidents, John F. Kennedy in 1960, Richard Nixon in 1968, and George W. Bush in 2000, had popular vote margins that were smaller than Donald Trump's. She quotes Hans Noel, associate professor of government at Georgetown University, noting, quote, if there ever was a mandate, this isn't it. Trump's commanding Electoral College victory, if that's the right way to describe it, of 312 votes to Harris's 226 is clearer. And unlike in 2016, when he beat former Secretary of State Hillary Clinton, he won the popular vote this time, if only a plurality and just barely. And he also did win the needed support in the Electoral College. So that is different. Democrats say that the results fall far short, however, of demonstrating majority public support for Donald Trump, and that the numbers do not give him a so-called mandate to deviate from precedent, such as naming cabinet members without Senate confirmation, as he had earlier insisted that he would, or bringing the military to enforce the mass deportation program that he promised throughout his campaign. In an election that almost all political pundits expected would be close and protracted, Trump reversed Democrats' 2020 gains, has been named the victor of all seven battleground states, and even made inroads with voters in blue states like California. Republicans also will take control of the Senate narrowly and retain their control of the U.S. House, if just barely. And after actually losing a seat from their previous very narrow majority margin. But, writes Jarvie, scholars of American politics have long been skeptical of the idea of a presidential mandate. The first president to articulate such concept was Andrew Jackson, the nation's seventh president, who viewed his 1832 reelection, in which he won 54.2% of the popular vote, as a mandate to destroy the Second Bank of the United States and expand his political authority in the bargain. In arguing that he had the mandate of the people, Jackson deviated from the approach of previous presidents in refusing to defer to Congress on policy. In Myth of the Presidential Mandate, Robert A. Dahl, a professor of political science at Yale University, argued the presidential mandate was, quote, harmful to American public life because it, quote, elevates the president to an exalted position in our constitutional system at the expense of Congress. Quote, How do we know what voters were thinking as they cast ballots, asks Julia R. Azari, professor of political science at Marquette University, in her 2014 book on presidential mandates, or on the lack thereof, in which she charges that it's politicians in weak positions who typically invoke mandates. This century, she wrote, presidents have cited mandates with increasing frequency as a result of the declining status of the presidency and growing national polarization. Quote, are some election mandates and others not, asks Azari. If so, how do we know? What's the popular vote cutoff? Is it a majority or more? Who decides? All excellent questions, of course. And as luck would have it, Marquette University's Julia Azari, author of Delivering the People's Message, The Changing Politics of Presidential Mandate, just happens to be here to answer them. Professor Azari, welcome to the broadcast.
Thank you so much for having me.
Delighted to have you here. In an article that you wrote, actually, at the Good Politics, Bad Politics Substack newsletter, where you're a contributor, on the day after this year's election, you argued in the piece headlined, Be Wary of Anyone Claiming an Election Mandate, that, quote, talking about mandates flattens public opinion rather than lifting it up. Of course, you wrote a whole book talking about mandates, Julia, but setting that aside, putting Donald Trump aside for the moment, just broadly speaking, how does talking about mandates flatten public opinion as you see it? Tell me more about that.
Yeah, so I wrote the book. I mean, the book came out when Obama was president. I started writing it when George W. Bush was president. So I had a lot of different opportunities to think about how this played out in a lot of different contexts. And perhaps one of the best examples to think through is actually one you mentioned in your intro, which is Lyndon Johnson in 1964. So that's one where a lot of people are really attached to that election as a mandate, and specifically a mandate for some of the things that Johnson did later. With a very, very robust public policy program. Mm-hmm. But when you think about an election where 60% of the electorate votes for one candidate, it really starts to be clear that they're going to have very different reasons for doing so. And undoubtedly, some people liked those plans. Other people, I think, one of the key reasons for that election result was people were nervous about Barry Goldwater.
Mm-hmm.
And you kind of saw that again, kind of more contemporary example with Barack Obama in 2008, where on the one hand, did people vote for what Obama said he was going to do? Was this a mandate for the Affordable Care Act and Obama's economic policies? Was it just they liked Obama? Were they just tired of Republicans, particularly if they blamed Republicans for the financial crash of 2008?
Mm-hmm.
And what I argue is these things are all always going on. There are some people that probably make very, very shallow decisions. There are some people who have really read the programs and have ideas in mind of what they want to happen going forward. And there are some people who are just voting kind of up or down on, are they happy with the party that's in power? And so instead of kind of thinking through all these different nuances and ins and outs of people's public opinion, people's attitudes and preferences, the mandate essentially lets the person in power decide what the election was about and allows them to kind of run with it. And I've been pretty critical of the way that presidents of both major parties have used that concept. Uh-huh. Although I would also note that in contemporary times that Republicans have been a lot more kind of focused and ideological in their mandate claiming.
Well, tell me about that. I mentioned from Jarvie's piece at the LA Times that Andrew Jackson was the first American president to characterize his win of, and it was just over 54% of the popular vote as a mandate at the time, in his case, to expand his own political authority. Jackson was the nation's seventh president. So in a general sense, if it's possible to sort of quickly summarize, how has the use of this, of presidents claiming mandates after victories, how has that changed over time in the U.S., as I know you detail in your book, Delivering the People's Message, The Changing Politics of the Presidential Mandate?
Yeah, there's, I think there are a couple of ways that this has changed. And one way I tracked it mostly through kind of modern politics. So I looked closely back at going back to Herbert Hoover and then poked around in some of these earlier cases. Mm-hmm. One is that presidents who have won much closer elections, or even in the case of George W. Bush, who lost the popular vote, they did sometimes talk about election mandates. They didn't use that word necessarily, but they talk about, well, here's the reason why I was elected. I said I'm going to do what I said I was going to do. And that's become a lot more common over time. And for Republicans specifically, kind of Reagan onward, mandate claiming has become a lot more kind of party focused and ideological. And one thing I found, I also did a bunch of archival work for this book, was there was a real kind of increase with Ronald Reagan of various conservative groups kind of talking about the 1980 election as a mandate and encouraging Reagan and his executive branch, to his administration, to think of or to think of their victory in those terms and to really think of it as an ideological mandate. And we saw George W. Bush very much pick up with that.
You, in your Substack column after Election Day, and by the way, congratulations being able to write on November 6 about any of this. you cite Yale's Robert Dahl, who, quote, warned us more than 30 years ago, assigning a popular mandate to the president carries specific and severe danger. Severe danger? How so? What are the dangers in a president declaring a so-called mandate?
Yeah, this is really, I think, you know, forces us to think about the nature of presidential power quite a bit, which is the point of Dahl's article. And that article is from, I think it's from 1990. So it's you know, many presidencies ago. It's really primarily pushing back on Reagan. Mm-hmm. But you see this really clearly in the example of Jackson. There's also the example of Woodrow Wilson, who thought a lot about the relationships across branches of government and how the president was kind of he kind of saw the president as the true representative of the whole people. Mm. And what we see there is that this gives the president a little bit of kind of extra power, at least in their own minds, that they feel justified in taking. And it enhances that power kind of over that of Congress, mm-hmm. rather than thinking about Congress as a co-equal branch. Mm-hmm. And as we're thinking about what, you know, may well happen in the next 4 years, one of the very first things that Trump was talking about was about recess appointments and about, you know, circumventing the role of the Senate to advise and consent his appointees. And so this is, I think, you know, all of these little examples of, medium-sized examples, the National Bank, Woodrow Wilson building up the executive branch, Trump's appointments, you know, maybe each one on its own does not fundamentally change the nature of the American Republic, but the more you give power to the executive, it does, you know, it does sort of accumulate and change the nature of a constitutional republic. And when that power is in the hands of somebody who isn't really keen on constitutional constraints, then, you know, we may see some serious consequences.
Oh, I'm sure. I have no idea who you're talking about there. But you're right. Not only does the power accumulate in the executive branch, but as it does, as that increases, it's got to come from somewhere. And in fact, it tends to come certainly with this new guy coming in from the from Congress. Trump's transition spokesperson, Carolyn Leavitt, has said, quote, the fake news is trying to minimize President Trump's massive and historic victory to try to delegitimize his mandate. She's also set, by the way, to become the new White House press secretary, so that should be fun. But in fairness, 4 years ago, after winning just 51.3% of the vote, it was a majority, unlike Trump's, but not a huge one, Joe Biden declared that he had a, quote, mandate for action. So I guess they sort of all do it now, though not necessarily with the phony bravado of Trump. But before we get to whether or not Trump actually has a mandate for anything, let's talk about some of those questions that the Times wrote from that you pose in your book. Are some election mandates, not others? If so, how do we know? Is there a popular cutoff for it? Who decides? Is there any actual sound political science to answer any of those questions?
So I think you kind of have two camps in political science. You have people who are really, really skeptical of the whole idea of mandates. And I think that includes, obviously, the late Robert Dahl, who we've mentioned, Hans Noel, who you've mentioned, and myself, among others. And then you have I think another camp that suggests there is kind of something to this concept. And typically one way to measure that out is a majority. And here again, looking to the kind of recent-ish past is useful. There's a book on presidential mandates from like 2001 by someone named Patricia Conley, and she cites Bill Clinton as an example of somebody who claimed a mandate but really had only won 43% of the vote, and so he wasn't successful in using that mandate to persuade Congress to do anything. Mm-hmm. He did. In his inaugural, he said something about the American people raising their voices in an unmistakable chorus after winning 43% of the vote.
Yes.
So, yeah, so, you
know. But to be fair, in that case, by the way, well, just a thought on that. It did come after 12 years of Republican presidents. So that's why I'm wondering if there's any, you know, I mean, it was if, you know, they characterized it a mandate for change. I mean, after 12 years of Republican presidents, they finally put a Democrat in there. I mean, is there any actual measure for that? Because a case, I think, could be made, even though it was 43% of the vote. But it doesn't seem like there's any actual science, you know, that helps us understand what a mandate is or isn't.
No, I think absolutely not. I mean, I think there's sort of two ways to think about this. And one is, you know, you win the election, do what you can do. Figure out what kind of coalition to govern you can build. And, you know, it's not that the platform or the promises don't matter at all. Those are out there. People know what you said you would do. Like, govern. There's a quote by John F. Kennedy where he essentially says that, like, my mandate is that I'm in office. And I think that's essentially how to think about it, if only because trying to search for a popular mandate typically gets associated with these you know, expansions of broader executive power, as opposed to thinking about, well, okay, here's what I want to do. How do I build a proper coalition to get it done? And that's where I think the second definition is not to be completely dismissed, which is to really think about the majority threshold. And again, this gets really fuzzy. Like, one of Dahl's examples is Ronald Reagan in 1981, like 50.8% of the popular vote. So as with any threshold, right, there are cases that are going to be very close to the threshold. But I do think it's worth thinking broadly in American politics about what are some moments where there is a national majority, even if, you know, only very briefly, and what are moments when a national majority is elusive, which is true apparently now. And also, I think it's significant, and 2024 does not erase the fact that Trump became president in 2016 with, you know, a pretty significant popular vote loss, you know, pretty similar to the margin by which he won in 2024, and nevertheless sort of governed in a way that would have suggested that he was more of a majority president. I think it's worth thinking about what is the kind of size of a coalition at any given time. Mm-hmm. Where is the majority of the nation? And if it's sort of nowhere or all over the place, that's useful information. But where I get nervous is when it's used to sort of suggest that the president deserves extra power because of his close relationship with the people or the clear message of the election.
If these so-called mandates that are claimed by these presidents or these president-elects, if they're not actually mandates, in the case of Bill Clinton, we mentioned mandate for change, what would be a more accurate or beneficial, at least to the voters, way to describe it?
Yeah, this is a good question. And it's been sort of a while since I thought about some of these mid-century presidents who were more circumspect about talking about their mandates. And I don't know if I would hold them up as examples either, Eisenhower or even Johnson. But I think that really the best thing for presidents to do is to govern and to explain why what they're doing is good for as many Americans as it can be. Mm-hmm. And really, like, one of the overall implications of my book that I've thought a lot about in the 10 years since it came out is how focused American politics has become on elections and how much elections take over they take so much time and they sort of take so much mental space.
Yeah.
And to really shift into, okay, here's a governing decision that I'm going to make, and here is why it's good. Not here's why you elected me to do it, because that makes it the people's fault, right? But here's why I'm taking responsibility for an idea that I'm going to pursue.
Yeah. You argue, again, in your post-election day piece at Good Politics, Bad Politics, quote, no election gives a leader more power than he is entitled to. And going on to paraphrase tyranny expert Tim Snyder, you charge the quote, repeating mandate narratives is obeying in advance. And I get that last part, certainly playing along with this president as if he was given what he described as a unprecedented and powerful mandate, unquote. That's certainly a form of obeying in advance. But you suggest that there really is no such thing as electoral mandates. How so?
I'm not totally sure I'm following the question here.
Well, I think you basically said there really is no such thing as a mandate, that it's that the people at any given time are voting for, you know, any number of issues all at once. And it doesn't signify, if I'm understanding it, you know, it doesn't signify that they are putting their support behind any one particular policy or idea that so many presidents claim, oh, this is my mandate to do X, Y, or Z.
Right. And I think, you know, one of the things I've acknowledged in subsequent writing is like that on some level makes democracy feel kind of impossible. And, you know, there's this other school of thought in political science that sort of suggests that, you know, parties run on something and people kind of know what that is and then they do vote for that. And so there is some coherence to the whole process. The nature of American politics makes that really dicey because we don't have like one election where a party wins or loses. We have a whole bunch of different elections. I think that really does come down to, and this is a little abstract, but I think it really does come down to the use of a kind of democratic and deliberative way of communicating with people once you're in office that engages with, okay, here is a problem, here is the problem to be solved. And that's an argument to make. Mm-hmm. And then here is the solution. Here are the pros and cons of different solutions. And this is the one I think that will be the best for us in the long term or for the most Americans. And here's how we will compensate and address the losers of this policy and really engage with people on the merits of the policy. And this is where I found contemporary mandate claiming to be kind of cowardly among various presidents is that they would often get in a kind of defensive crouch when talking to journalists or in other contexts and say, well, I'm doing what I was elected to do. Mm-hmm. And again, that sort of like puts the onus on the people in a way that is a little bit inappropriate because the people have elected you and they've actually elected you to do a job and use your judgment and take responsibility. And so that's where I kind of see a thing where, you know, presidential rhetoric and other thing, you know, media analysis of politics, all this stuff has become very election focused and not as focused on what are the policies, what are the reasons for the policies, who are the winners and losers, and how will we address the fallout of a particular change. And as a result, we've been in this, I think, holding pattern since the Obama years, where there's not a lot of governing happening and there are a lot of major issues aren't getting addressed.
Right.
Right. Including issues that have majority support. And that's, I think that's really telling. And the Affordable Care Act resulted in massive midterm losses. And I think that was a sort of story about the short-lived nature of a party mandate.
So much for that mandate, right?
Yeah.
Although you mentioned Barack Obama, I'm asking this because, you know, with Donald Trump, he ran his campaign really from start to finish by, you know, claiming, oh, we're going to have mass deportations and dealing with immigration, whatever that whatever that may mean to him. He's, you know, made promise to throw out millions of people. Well, it makes me think to back to, again, Barack Obama running, for example, against John McCain in 2008. One of the big promises from the beginning to the end of his campaign was to end George W. Bush's war in Iraq. And McCain was a big supporter of the war at the time. Obama ended up winning. Doesn't winning in such an election by what, at least in that case, you know, in modern by modern day standards was a bit of a landslide. Wouldn't Obama back in 2008 have the right to claim his victory as a mandate to get out of Iraq, for example, in a way that, you know, Trump could say, hey, I ran on mass deportation. So and they voted for me. So that's my mandate.
Right. I mean, that's essentially what they do is make those sorts of claims. I think somewhere in Obama didn't talk about Iraq that way very much, but I think there was some reference. I should have reread my own book.
Well, he ran against Hillary Clinton to get the nomination in the first place based on her vote in favor of the war and while he was against the war.
Right. But that, I mean, that's kind of the thing, too, is like when you start looking at the primary, we've now really multiplied all the potential reasons why people might have voted.
Right.
And I think, let me say this. I think in both cases, presidents have the right to do the things that their power, you know, allows them to do, whether that's conduct foreign policy and end a war, whether that's establish immigration priorities, even if people disagree with those priorities. But they also have to live with the policy and the political fallout of those decisions. And that's where I think, you know, that we haven't obviously seen all this come to pass. We don't know exactly what Trump will do or how he'll justify it. But what I anticipate may happen is that he'll pursue some of these mass deportation things that he said he would do. People will dislike it for one reason or another, for humanitarian or community reasons, or simply because it has an impact on the economy. And Trump's defense is likely to be, well, you know, this is what I said I would do, and I'm doing it. And that is not owning the consequences of those actions.
Yeah. Excellent point. And by the way, can politicians for other offices aside from presidency, can they claim mandates, or does your rule the idea that really there's no such thing as a mandate? Does that really apply to all elections for all offices?
I think it does apply to all offices, although one of the things that I started to see kind of after the book came out was the prediction I had made about the kind of age of mandate politics continued to be true. And there was kind of talk about different elections as kind of waves or mandates. There's another book called Mandate Politics that looks at 1964, 1980, and also 1994, and kind of the ways in which the Gingrich Revolution was depicted by media as a particular kind of party mandate. I think the trick there is it's one thing if you're governor or mayor, maybe, but for members of Congress to claim your own mandate, it's like you can do that until you're blue in the face. It doesn't matter. Right. You have to act with other people.
Right.
So if you can convince people that your party has a mandate, or you can convince the other people in your party that they have a mandate to do something specific, then, you know, then that might be politically advantageous.
So when we hear a president, in this case, an incoming president, arguing that he or hopefully someday she received a mandate from the people, how should we actually hear that? What should our response be? And frankly, what should the media's response be to that?
I think it should be sort of skeptical and critical. I think that media have a responsibility to think about how power flows, and not just, and this is kind of what I was getting at with my obeying in advance comment, is not just to repeat what politicians say, but to really investigate, you know, if that were true, what would it mean about power? If that were true, what would we see in the electorate? What do voters actually want to see in terms of policy? Is there a coherent story about what voters want to see in terms of policy? I suspect the answer to that is no. that's, you know, that I think that's, that would be my advice there.
And I think it's advice that, given our corporate media, it will probably not follow. I mean, this is, you know, an extremely narrow victory for Donald Trump. Less than 1.5 points win over Kamala Harris. And once again, a minority of the vote. But I suspect we're going to see the corporate media treating him as if he does have a mandate, which is why I'm trying to understand, Julia Azari, how best to understand what actually happened and how to cover it and how to help the electorate understand what just happened. And, I think we're going to have to do a lot of figuring on that score. And that's why I really appreciated, you know, your coverage the day after, essentially saying be wary of anyone claiming an election mandate. And of course, as it turns out, it was much, much closer than it even seemed on November 6th. So thank you for doing that. Julia Azari is professor of political science at Marquette University. Her book is Delivering the People's Message, The Changing Politics of the Presidential Mandate. And you can find her on the no longer, I think, on Twitter, but happily now on Blue Sky at juliaazari.bsky.social. Julia, really appreciate you joining us here today on the broadcast.
Thank you so much.
Thank you. Okay, all great points. And
yeah.
I'm sure that the corporate media can't wait to completely ignore them. Yes,
yeah,
exactly.
I mean, I appreciated that she says media have a responsibility to investigate,
yes,
not just to repeat what politicians,
yes,
say, to actually say, is that true? And not just say, okay, well, we got to leave it there.
Right. Well, when you have more than half of the country voting for someone other than the guy who's about to go into office, yeah, that's what our system allows for. That's how the Electoral College works. But that does not mean they have a governing mandate. That
right.
actually means more voters voted against whatever he's going to now do.
So
investigate
those claims.
All right, we got to get out. Thank you very much once again to Julia Azari. And thanks to our producer, Desi Doyen. And, of course, thanks to all of you for spending a portion of your day or night with us. It's always appreciated. It's always an honor. If you missed any portion of today's show, you can download it anytime for free at bradblog.com. That is made possible thanks to those of you who hit a donate button over there or go straight to bradblog.com/donate. To help us out here, help us stay on your public airwaves. We could not do it without you. You're the only ones keeping us here. So decide wisely. Drop me an email if you like. I'm bradcast@bradblog.com. You can find me on the social medias. Yes, now including and especially including Blue Sky at The Brad Blog. We will see you there. Till we see you here again, hopefully tomorrow, I'm Brad Friedman. Good luck, world.
The gentleman is a dope, a man of many faults, a clumsy Joe who wouldn't know rumba from a waltz. The gentleman is a dope.
You're listening to The Bradcast. We are 100% listener supported, thanks to listeners like you who drop by bradblog.com/donate.